Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, wastewater and sewage are proving to be valuable sources of information about COVID-19. Also, one of the oldest quarantine stations still in existence is the Lazaretto Station just south of Philly, heavily in use during the 19th century to house people suffering other epidemics. But first, Democratic Congressman Andy Kim joins us to start the show. Kim represents New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District and was recently appointed to the new House Select Committee on the Coronavirus Crisis, an oversight panel meant to add another level of scrutiny to the Trump administration's crisis response efforts and the trillions being spent to keep businesses and individuals afloat. The committee is also supposed to be bipartisan, but it's not clear Republicans will take part. Lots to talk about. We'll begin by discussing the panel's work, which will likely be carried out under some coronavirus restrictions. Congressman Andy Kim, nice to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Paycheck Protection Program. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been made available to help small businesses stay in business. But Andy Kim, as we know, it's been a bumpy ride. The initial $349 billion in loan money quickly ran out. Even more disturbingly, a fair number of larger companies did a workaround and received millions in aid. The Paycheck Protection Program came together quickly, probably had to. But with speed comes the risk for important oversight measures to fall through the cracks. How do we ensure that millions and even billions don't fall into the wrong hands as we move forward?
Well, first, we need to be listening to the small business owners. I get hundreds of calls from them every single day to be able to understand the problems that they're having, the difficulties that they're facing, the obstacles that stand in their way between getting the funds that they need. So we need to make sure that they're in the room. We need to make sure that we're doing this work. I'm the only member of Congress from New Jersey on the Small Business Committee, so this has become a real personal mission of mine to just make sure that we're hearing from them and fixing the problems. And the problems are that, you know, we don't have feedback mechanisms to back to the SBA, to Treasury, to be able to explain the problems that small businesses are having. There's no transparency. They're not even, you know, these owners are not even getting calls or emails about where things stand and where their loans are in the process. So, you know, that's the kind of feedback, that's the kind of fixes that we need to make sure that we're having.
Read in the New York Times that the government isn't disclosing who receives aid, that it's up to the companies to tell whether they've obtained loans. Is this still the case? And why keep recipients secret?
Yeah, this is ridiculous. I mean, this is the funding from the American people to be able to support small businesses, those that are most vulnerable in their time of greatest need. And this should not be something that is, you know, hidden from the public. You know, this is the largest rescue package and relief package in the history of our country. And we need to make sure that we're spending this wisely. So with the Select Committee that I'm on and also with the Small Business Committee that I'm on, we are pressing for that transparency and making sure that this money was used wisely, which, you know, we see all sorts of indications that it was not.
Congress could soon consider a package to deliver aid to state and local governments worth at least $1 trillion. When we had you last on a number of weeks ago, Congressman Andy Kim, we were talking about adding, I think at the time, $1 trillion to the deficit. Now the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting a budget deficit of $3.5 trillion. At what point do we say this might be unsustainable, or is there any other choice?
Well, right now with New Jersey, for instance, you know, we are in a really bad situation. We have one of the largest positive cases in the entire world. We are nearing 10,000 killed. We are at the front lines of this. And that's what this is about. You know, this is not about, you know, bailing out states left and right because of budgetary issues. This is about a national security crisis. And we need to be treating it like that. And that is not what's been happening. If the White House is serious in saying that states need to take the lead on testing, on contact tracing, on any number of other issues, then we need to make sure that the funds are there. And when it comes to New Jersey, look, we've been paying more than our fair share into the federal government for decades. We only get back about 81 cents for every dollar we put into the federal government. And so what we're just trying to do here is just get back a fair amount for us to be able to work through one of the worst national security crises imaginable. So that's what this is about. I hope people just put aside the partisanship, put aside the longstanding bickerings about blue states, red states, and just try to help out those that are the front lines and look at it that way.
But also the fact that at some point we're going to have to deal with a budget deficit of $3.5 trillion.
Absolutely. Look, we absolutely need to do that. Right now, we need to be focused on saving lives, and that is certainly one aspect of it. And then when we're looking at what happens going forward, we are working on that. We are going to make sure that we're going to take responsible policies to be able to address the tremendous situation. But, you know, we are simultaneously experiencing a health pandemic that is taking countless lives, as well as the potential for a major financial crisis, even bigger than what we're experiencing right now. So we need to make sure that we do everything we can to stop those two simultaneous crises.
How might the committee do its work? The House has not, as of yet, returned to Washington, and I think it recently sidelined a plan to allow representatives to vote remotely, Andy Kim.
The House needs to come back, and we need to get to work. Right now, we are working. We are working around the clock. Certainly, my office is fielding hundreds of calls from constituents every day. We are working through the different legislation that we're doing, but we know we can do it better. We can do it more effectively and efficiently in person. You know, those steps need to come together, and I'm hoping that we can find the right types of protocols to be able to ensure that we can handle it in terms of health concerns that are lingering. So that is something we're working through. In the meantime, with regards to the Select Committee, you know, the Republican side has recently named their appointees to this committee. So mm-hmm. We are now moving forward in a bipartisan way, and we're hoping to be able to identify the places where we can be of most impact. So we are certainly doing a lot, pushing forward quickly on getting the transparency and then pressing for information about publicly traded companies and others that are taking advantage of the PPP program. We're also doing a lot in terms of next steps, in terms of thinking through how to safely reopen and how to prepare for a second wave later this year that experts like Dr. Fauci say is inevitable.
How do we keep partisan politics at bay during a crisis in a heated election year?
Well, this is something that is going to rest on every single individual to make that commitment. You know, for me, as a former national security official, I was a career official at the State Department and worked at the Pentagon. I was someone who worked under both Republicans and Democrats. I always say the last place that partisan politics belongs is in national security. And I'm doing everything I can to be able to abide by that and work through that. So right now, it's about delivering for our constituents, making sure that that all of them are getting the information that they need to be able to stay safe and to try to get through and pay the bills, and about doing the work that we need to do. You know, we're in this crisis situation. I've seen us be able to pull together at times and put this aside. It's doable. We just need to make sure we make that commitment, and the constituents need to hold elected officials to that and really make sure that that is what they're abiding by.
You have called the coronavirus pandemic the largest national security crisis to ever affect the U.S. How is the pandemic a national security crisis?
Well, it's a national security crisis because this is about saving lives. This is about every aspect of our society under threat. It's about every corner of this country under threat. And this is something where we have a playbook for how we can get through this. This is something I saw firsthand when I worked at the National Security Council at the White House. I saw how experts can come together and put together the types of strategies and plans to be able to get through this. That is why we have a national security apparatus. And it's about working together in the Situation Room and across this country to put that playbook into motion. So what we need to do is make sure we're listening to these experts, that we're putting this together, and we have a whole government approach. And this is exactly why it is I keep calling for greater federal support for testing, for contact tracing. I've asked FEMA repeatedly to set up a third testing site here in South Jersey, and they repeatedly keep rejecting my request. But having worked in the federal government, I know the resources that they can provide during a national security crisis, and I know that those resources are not maximized to their fullest potential right now. And that is what I'm going to try to keep pushing for.
The committee
to increase testing and support our communities.
The committee you sit on, Andy Kim, plans to crack down on price gouging. What are the ideas here?
Well, the problem that we have writ large is that we have a situation where we don't have federal coordination on personal protective equipment and any number of other issues. So we have counties like Burlington County and Ocean County fighting against other counties. We have New Jersey fighting against other states for this type of equipment. So first and foremost, we need to have a national coordination process on this to make sure we're not becoming our own worst enemy and increasing the prices in that way. But we also need to fully enforce the mechanisms that we have to be able to stop the price gouging where people are now selling N95 masks for 5 to 10 times the price that it was just half a year ago. These are situations where people are just trying to take advantage of the panic and the chaos that's out there. So first of all, have a coordinated system that in and of itself can be able to address some of the inefficiencies that have caused such huge problems. Like, we can't even get right now enough personal protective equipment, yeah, not only for healthcare workers at hospitals, but also these long-term care facilities that are getting ravaged by this disease. Yeah. It is just a massive tragedy what's happening at these nursing homes, long-term care centers, many of them in my own district. And we just need to make sure we're getting them that equipment, and they're not going to be taken advantage of in that type of process. So, you know, these are the types of things that I hope we can prioritize and try to help save lives with.
We are taking comments this hour of Radio Times. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is a little off topic, Andy Kim, but we have a question from Jane who asks, are we in danger of losing the post office?
We are. We are very much in danger of seeing the post office in tremendous financial crisis. You know, this is something that they were already having this problem even before this coronavirus crisis, as there is this burden placed upon them to pay up front 75 years in advance benefits to their employees, to their retirees. You know, these are huge problems that were already hampering this organization. So they are under tremendous strain. And given the fact that they are a lifeline to so many of us right now, keeping us connected, making the deliveries, they even do so many of the deliveries for other companies like UPS and FedEx, and they're the largest employer of veterans in our entire country. This should be a commitment that we make to make sure that we're supporting them, make sure that we can push forward, and even for when we're looking at doing you know, massive amounts of vote by mail for upcoming elections, yeah, this is going to be critical. So they are a pillar of our democracy and our society, and we should make sure that they are protected.
Representative Andy Kim of New Jersey, New Jersey's 3rd District, is always a pleasure, and stay in touch. Great to have you with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right, up next on Radio Times, we're going to be talking about the Lazaretto Quarantine Center, which operated in the 19th century during other epidemics. Penn Professor David S. Barnes will be with us. It's a great story, and we hope you stay with us for that.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Lazaretto Quarantine Station is a stark reminder that we in the 21st century are not the first to suffer deadly epidemics. Lazaretto is a strikingly grand brick structure not far from Philadelphia International Airport. Built in 1799, it sits along the banks of the Delaware River in Tinicum Township. And during the 19th century, it was a mandatory stop for ships and their crews and immigrant travelers headed upriver toward Philadelphia. At the time, diseases like yellow fever and typhus had the potential to wipe out entire populations. The Lazaretto attempted to stop imported illness in its tracks. The story of the Lazaretto quarantine station and its place in Philadelphia history is fascinating. And David S. Barnes has made researching the Lazaretto a personal quest for, I think it's at least the past dozen years. David Barnes is Associate Professor of History and Sociology of Science at the University of Pennsylvania. And welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin by talking about the word Lazaretto and the concept of the quarantine station, which, David, you have found dates back to the late 14th century in Europe.
That's right. The word Lazaretto is Italian, and it comes from the biblical figure Lazarus, a beggar covered with sores, who became the patron saint of lepers. So the first leper colonies or isolation hospitals for people with leprosy were called Lazarettos, and that name came to be attached to a variety of isolation hospitals and quarantine facilities in the ports around the Mediterranean in the time of bubonic plague. So beginning with the Black Death of the 14th century, and then a few centuries later, by the 16th to 17th centuries, most of the major ports in the Mediterranean and other parts of Europe had some kind of Lazaretto or quarantine station.
So what prompted the construction of the Lazaretto quarantine station near Philadelphia in the final days of the 18th century?
Well, it was yellow fever. There were four devastating epidemics of yellow fever in the 1790s in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia at the time was the nation's capital. It was the nation's largest city, and it was the nation's busiest seaport. It was the center of intellectual and cultural activity in the young United States. And it's impossible to overstate how traumatic these epidemics were. In 1793, a tenth of the city's population, 5,000 people, were killed in the span of about 2 months. And then yellow fever came back again in 1797, again in 1798, again in 1799. It started to feel like this was an annual occurrence. And there was even some doubt as to whether Philadelphia could continue to exist as a city, or whether any large cities could exist on this continent. Thomas Jefferson, who was vice president during the 1798 epidemic, wrote to his friend Benjamin Rush, a prominent Philadelphia physician, that he hoped that yellow fever would cause the depopulation of Philadelphia and other major cities, because Jefferson was deeply suspicious of cities and urban life.
Really?
So, yeah. And in response to this deep trauma, the city of Philadelphia decided to build a new, big, and state-of-the-art quarantine station farther away from the city than the previous quarantine outpost. And that was the genesis of the Lazaretto on what then was Tinicum Island.
At the time, David S. Barnes, medical science was divided on how diseases like yellow fever and typhus worked and on treatment. Tell us about that.
There was vehement disagreement among doctors in the late 18th and early 19th century about the nature and causes of disease. Take yellow fever as an example. Many doctors were convinced that yellow fever was contagious, i.e. spread from person to person, and it was brought into cities like Philadelphia on ships from areas where yellow fever was more or less endemic, such as the West Indies. It was a very frequent commerce and travel back and forth between ports like Philadelphia and various ports in the West Indies. Another group of doctors said, hogwash, this disease is not contagious at all, and it's not coming in from anywhere else. It originates locally. That is, accumulations of filth in the streets and alleyways and courtyards of Philadelphia under certain weather conditions, especially hot, wet weather in the late summertime, could generate miasmas or could generate disease-causing emanations that could spread disease throughout the population. So in a city like Philadelphia, each yellow fever outbreak was highly localized in the crowded neighborhoods bordering the port.
Okay, that was my next question. Yeah, which ones were most immediately affected? So along the port areas.
Yeah, in Philadelphia, every time yellow fever visited the city, it was highly localized in a very narrow strip of land between the Delaware River and about 2nd Street, and then bordered on the north by about Vine Street and on the south by Catherine Street or so. So very narrow strip of land. However, that was the busiest and most crowded area of the city. The doctors who thought that yellow fever was coming in on the ship said, see, it's always right by the port. That's because it's coming in on the ship.
So thankfully, they won the day and constructed the station.
This is the most crowded and filthy neighborhood of the city. So that proves our point.
Were they both right, just quickly, in a way? I mean,
were both right, in a way. We discovered around 1900 that yellow fever was spread by a particular mosquito. And the mosquito thrives in crowded, dirty urban areas. And it's not spread from person to person, but it is spread much more easily when people are crowded close together.
Okay. What was the process like for ships, for those and those on board who stopped at the Lazaretto? What did they undergo?
A lot of boredom. And some of them were really desperately hungry and sick. On the large immigrant ships of the 19th century, they were carrying people who had next to no resources, and food was always in short supply. So just imagine enduring a sea voyage that could take up to 2 months, and with very little food, crowded together in horrendous conditions, and finally, on the doorstep of your destination, being forced to wait for maybe a day, maybe a couple of weeks, in some cases, a couple of months or more. It was tremendously frustrating, and quarantine was always deeply unpopular.
So what did the doctors do at the Lazaretto? Did they just say, you know, you're here and you can get back on, you over there can get back on the ship? I mean, was it, what did the process look like?
Well, ships stopped to be inspected. By law, every ship had to stop to be inspected. And sometimes it was routine and pretty quick, but the Lazaretto physician and the quarantine master rode out to the ships and inspected the ship, inspected the cargo, and inspected the physical appearance of the crew and the passengers. Anyone who was sick was immediately admitted into the hospital at the Lazaretto and given medical care until they recovered or died. Those who were healthy, if the ship was detained, would normally have to stay on board the ship. However, in some cases, the ships had to be thoroughly disinfected. In other words, ventilated, treated with fumigation or various kinds of liquid chemical disinfectants. And in those cases, if the ship had to be completely unloaded of all its cargo and passengers, the passengers would be temporarily housed on land at the Lazaretto, either in the buildings that were on site or occasionally in tents that would be sent down from the city for their temporary accommodation. And they waited, and they sent mail if they could to family members or business associates, and they waited and they endured a lot of boredom and frustration.
Perhaps astoundingly, considering the times, most patients who were compelled to stay at the Lazaretto survived these deadly illnesses. Why was that?
It's very surprising. We don't have records for all of the 19th century, but we have very detailed records for the Lazaretto Hospital in the second half of its existence, so roughly 1847 through the closure of the Lazaretto in the mid-1890s. And the most common illnesses treated at the Lazaretto Hospital were yellow fever and typhus, both often fatal diseases, both incurable in the 19th century. Yellow fever still to this day has no single generally effective treatment. And certainly typhus is now treatable by antibiotics, but not in the 19th century. And when you look through the hospital register at the Lazaretto, you see the very far right-hand column of these registers has the outcome for each patient. And down every single page, you see cured, 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 cured. It's very strange, and I had to laugh when I first saw it because I thought, how could they call these patients cured? There's no cure for yellow fever even today.
Really?
But what they meant was the patients recovered, and they left the hospital on their own power in good health or in decent health. And for yellow fever, I think it was 78% of patients recovered. For typhus, it was 95% of patients recovered. And my theory is that these patients, you know, didn't receive any magic medicine at the Lazaretto. They received basic nursing care. I call this the care cure. When patients who are sick with these potentially deadly infectious diseases receive sufficient food, rest, clean clothing, clean bedding, and basic nursing care, the illness runs its course, and the nursing care blunts the most acute symptoms and keeps the patients alive long enough for the body to recover on its own.
So who are Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's what explains the surprising cure rates, quote unquote, at the Lazaretto Hospital.
Tell us about the immigrants of the time and the process of immigrating to the United States. It was a lot simpler then than it is now.
It was simpler in some respects, but it wasn't pretty. It turns out that immigration from Europe to North America in the 19th century was a big business. People profited off of the poor and desperate of Europe. There was a whole network of recruiters who traveled the towns and villages of various parts of Europe, peddling these grand dreams of freedom and riches in the New World. And these recruiters were directly or indirectly in the pay of the shipping companies and the ship captains, who made a lot of money off of cramming hundreds and hundreds of desperately poor immigrants into these cargo ships to take them across the ocean. And in the first part of the 19th century, many of the immigrants were called redemptioners. In other words, they didn't have the money to pay for their passage. So once they arrived, they were indentured off as servants for a specified period of time in order to pay the cost of their passage. And this recruiting system systematically deceived and robbed these poor immigrants of their few possessions. And the ships themselves were essentially typhus factories, these horrible, crowded, filthy conditions. The passengers were basically starved. There was never enough food or water. And in those conditions, you know, typhus was rampant, and many of the passengers never made it to Philadelphia or to the New World.
David S. Barnes,
you
know, I keep jumping in. I apologize. We've got so much to say and only a couple minutes more in which to do this interview. We have a question from Chris who says, who got stuck with the bill for the time spent quarantining? The patients?
Great question. The ship owner was supposed to pay any costs associated with quarantine. That includes food provided to the passengers or crew. That included medical care, and that included board or basic sort of daily fee per head. And the city officials had to recover those costs from the ship owners. And often the ship owners resisted or tried to avoid paying, and there were legal proceedings involved. But in theory, at least, the ship owner had to pay the cost.
So tell us the story of the Lazaretto from, I think you said it was 1895 when it finally closed to its closed its quarantine work till today. You know, what happened to it? Who used it? And how did it come to look as it does today? From pictures, it looks absolutely spectacular.
It is spectacular. The afterlife of a quarantine station was strange and fascinating. In the quarantine station closed down in 1895. In 1898, the Athletic Club of Philadelphia, essentially a recreational club for the elite of the city, leased the Lazaretto as a country club, as a summer resort. And so the members of the athletic club would go to the Lazaretto and play lawn tennis or lawn bowling or quoits, which is sort of like horseshoes, or baseball. Baseball was played on the Lazaretto ground. It was a popular destination for bicycling outings during the bicycling craze of the 1890s. And they had fancy banquets. At the Lazaretto, it was very scenic. It was bucolic. It was away from the hustle and bustle and heat of the city. And they had fishing and hunting outings there. And then around 1915, a couple of members of the athletic club were also aviation buffs. And they bought a few seaplanes, which were then called flying boats. And they started a flying school at the Lazaretto.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It turned into a seaplane base and flying school that operated until 2000.
Unfortunately, I have to jump in on you again. I do apologize. But the end of the story, we've got about 20 seconds left, is that it was purchased by Tinicum Township, which essentially saved it.
Yes, Tinicum Township saved the Lazaretto by purchasing the property, saving it from a developer who wanted to build an airport parking garage, and decided to move its township offices to the main building of the Lazaretto. And just a few months ago, in February, the restoration was completed and the township moved into its offices. The main building looks spectacular.
David,
I recommend that listeners go take a look.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As portions of the country and Pennsylvania begin to reopen, the race is on to determine the scope of the coronavirus pandemic in regions across the country. There are a number of tools in the toolbox available to researchers, and for the remainder of the hour, we are going to take a close look at one, which is aesthetically unappealing, actually gross, but at the same time surprisingly effective. Sewage and raw wastewater can contain valuable information about the infection rate of local populations. And a Massachusetts firm called BioBot Analytics has partnered with researchers at MIT, Harvard, and Brigham and Women's Hospital to use effluent to help map COVID-19 across the country. New Castle County, Delaware is taking part in this project. We'll hear about what scientists have found there in just a moment. But first, let's introduce Mariana Mattis, a biologist and co-founder of BioBot Analytics. Hello, Mariana. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's great to have you here. As off-putting as raw effluent is, apparently it contains a lot of information about the households from which it emerges. Tell us more.
Yeah, we think about wastewater not as waste, but as a data source, an untapped source of information about human health and behavior. And the reason why that's the case is because our urine and stool contain tons of information about our health, including the novel coronavirus.
So COVID-19 can be detected in wastewater. Is it live virus? in wastewater?
It's not really known yet. However, evidence so far indicates that the SARS-CoV-2 virus shed in stool is inactive. Researchers have had a difficult time trying to isolate and grow the virus from stool. So by extension, most of the virus in wastewater is also expected to be inactive. Okay. But there are studies ongoing about that question.
According to published reports, Mariana, the virus can be detected in wastewater as much as 2 weeks before the person or people carrying it become ill enough to seek medical attention. Why is this important?
That is really important because it means that wastewater can serve as an early warning system about the reemergence of the virus in a community. People can start shedding the virus in stool pretty early on before they develop full symptoms and therefore seek medical care. And during that time, you know, they can be infectious, be around in the community, still they don't know they have it. So the wastewater can really give you that early warning that the virus is present again in a community.
So far, you've determined that there's much more COVID-19 in the population than initial estimates are indicating?
Correct. Yes, and I should say that our work is still preliminary. We're still refining our estimates to make sure that we are giving the best data, the most accurate data possible. But so far, very consistently, we have seen a discrepancy in the levels that we find versus the reported clinical cases.
Guessing you can't determine whether any one person has the virus from testing wastewater, but is the science, Mariana, specific enough to point to a certain neighborhood in which there might be a fair number of infections?
Yeah, it all depends on how you collect your sample. At the moment, our pro bono campaign is receiving wastewater samples from wastewater treatment plants. That means that the resolution of the data is really that kind of municipality or county level. However, you can also collect samples within the wastewater network to get more of a granular view, neighborhood level resolution.
BioBot is working with Newcastle County in Delaware, investigating wastewater and sewage output there. What have you found in Newcastle? What's the latest?
We have found that they have, according to our results, many more infected individuals than the official records show. And this has really kind of brought attention to their community. They want to further investigate what's the reason for the discrepancy. As you can imagine, this may point to large asymptomatic populations that haven't been diagnosed and that could still be out and about infecting people. This could really point at a need to maintain the mitigation efforts until the reported cases and the wastewater data much better.
As of mid-April, I think, there were, I think BioBot found more than 15,000 cases, at least according to its analysis of wastewater from Newcastle County. That's 15 times the 974 cases that had been confirmed. And that's as of mid-April, and we're approaching mid-May. Have you spoken recently with Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer about what the county is considering moving forward with this data, even as the country begins to reopen?
Well, in their case, they want to continue producing data for the next few weeks so that we can understand how their data continues to trend. If, you know, if it continues to go up, if maybe it has leveled off, or if maybe we were even seeing a decrease. That's the main feedback that them and other participating communities have in our program. They want to understand how our data trends to have another data point that informs the reopening of cities.
Mariana Mattis is a biologist and co-founder of Biobot Analytics, and we are taking calls at 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join us. Or you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So can this research being used, is it currently being used to determine whether a large swath of a region is good to go to begin reopening, Mariana?
It can be used as one of several data sources to make that decision. Something that it's very important to point out is that our data doesn't substitute the patient-level clinical testing, but it does complement it. It is showing us a bit of a different view of the community, and you can think about it as a data puzzle, where we want to be able to be looking at the patient data, antibody testing, random testing surveys, as well as wastewater data, to really understand where that community is at in the curve, and therefore what's appropriate for that community in terms of mitigation versus reopening the economy.
So the lack of adequate access to testing humans for the virus is a huge issue as we're trying to corral this pandemic. You're saying the testing for the virus in wastewater is not a substitute. It's just one of many tools to look at as we consider reopening.
Absolutely. And, you know, different parts of the country have been impacted differently and may have different limitations for the testing. So again, maybe in some parts of the country, the testing is actually quite okay. Maybe in others, it's really lagging behind. But in either case, the wastewater data just serves as a complementary view of the community and lets you know, if the numbers are kind of matching, it could indicate that the community has been very good about diagnosing and isolating the people who are infected. If the numbers don't match, if our numbers are much higher, that indicates that you could have a large asymptomatic population that you don't really know who they are and are still like active in the community and potentially infectious.
And then possibly a second wave of coronavirus infection.
If
edicts are lifted too quickly. Not sure you can answer this question, Mariana, but I'm going to toss it out anyway. Are there reopenings that are happening now in some regions, even in northern areas of Pennsylvania, which perhaps shouldn't be happening according to data you might have?
So we let communication of results directly to the participating communities. So, indeed, I cannot comment on specific regions of the country. However, I think that our intention right now is to make sure that this data exists and that people know about it and that, our leaders can use this new tool to understand the impact of their policies. So I really appreciate the opportunity to share with your audience and to really spread the word about this new tool and how useful it can potentially be in answering precisely that question.
How might information from wastewater help hospitals with readiness?
Absolutely. As you know, there are models, forecast models, to understand the impact of the outbreak on hospital capacity. And we are in conversation with some of the top epidemiologists in the country who are building these models and who are interested in informing some of the parameters of their models with this new type of data.
Let's talk about potential challenges with investigating wastewater for COVID. Are you facing skepticism, Mariana Mattis, from some local officials who might doubt that wastewater can be of real use here?
Yeah, absolutely. With every new technology, there's always a period of education. And as you can imagine, really hearing for the first time that wastewater wastewater can give you epidemiological data is just very shocking to people. So right now, really, we think the best we can do in this moment is to, again, try to inform people that this is possible. This technology has been used in the past already to predict poliovirus outbreaks in countries that are polio-free very, very successfully. So it is a technology that has already a history. It has a large research community behind it, and I think that hopefully we'll be able to bridge more of that gap to the folks who can actually use the data.
And help local officials get past the ick factor, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So BioBot is in Massachusetts. What's the turnaround if, say, a sample has to get to you from across the country? And is that lag time especially critical as you're trying to determine, as you're trying to map COVID-19?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, the participating wastewater treatment plants send back samples, and we pay for the sample to get here the next day. And then the samples enter our laboratory analysis process that at the moment is done in collaboration with MIT. And then finally, we do the data analysis and the reporting back to them. At the moment, whenever our process is working well from beginning to end, that takes about 5 days. However, we have also had issues, you know, just scaling some parts of the platform, all of these being such a new type of work that we do in the company. So just like, I don't know, last week we had a couple of teammates went into quarantine, which means that now we need to quickly scramble to kind of get through the work with less people. So definitely operating during an outbreak also poses operational challenges as an organization. Yeah. But that's also something that we're always trying to improve, to build redundancy, and to basically get it to the point where they can start getting results within 3 days of returning their sample.
And as you throw the net out, how many entities do you want to become involved in this? Do you want to become involved in this project from across the country? I'm talking about local municipalities and et cetera. I think it was, the figure right now is, what, 137?
Yeah, actually, last week we reopened enrollment for the pro bono campaign, and it seems that we have hit already the new capacity limit that we set, which is about 400 participating wastewater treatment plants. Yes. The response has been amazing. It's really great to see that wastewater treatment plants staff, engineers, leaders are so receptive to the idea of helping out during the outbreak with the tools that they have.
And we referenced Delaware County earlier in this segment. Are there other spots in the Philadelphia area that are working with you that come to mind among the 400?
Not top of mind, but I know for most states, we do have, you know, at least like a dozen participating communities. So I wouldn't be surprised if we had more representation from the area as well.
Okay. So, Mariana, one more question. Is wastewater testing accurate enough on a local level to potentially allow local reopenings of businesses and even schools in smaller towns?
Oh, that would be amazing. I think that we have actually received interest from like smaller communities, like nursing homes, prison systems, as well as just like work campuses, trying to understand how this data can give them an early warning for the outbreak being in the community or like basically spiking like out of a baseline. So right now, our team is thinking about how to support that approach. It's really, for us right now, a matter of bandwidth, but we would love to be able to help maybe later this year with that type of program.
Well, as the project develops, we'll be watching. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure, Mariana Mattis.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mariana Mattis is a biologist and co-founder of Biobot Analytics. And as always, a plug for our social media presence here at WHYY. You can find everything you need to know about Radio Times at WHYY.org. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times. Be well.